And he may even say, but above party politics, and he may even expect an encomium to be showered upon him when he says that I do not belong to this or that party. You can afford to be outside party, but you can never be outside politics. And even if you say that you are outside politics, politics is not prepared to leave you outside the family. Therefore it is that I say that the plea put forward by my friend Mr. Narayana Sami is very timely. Not only members of the bar, but the entire intellectual section of this country should take it into their consideration whether the time has not come for them to take active interest, if not in party politics, at any rate in the general politics of this country. So I am very glad that at least my friend Mr. Narayana Sami put forward this bold suggestion. Perhaps it is due to the fact that he is my friend. It may be due to the fact also that he has had his glorious days on the bar, and therefore he can afford to come out to the wider field of politics too. I am here today concerned to talk to you as a layman. If I were to talk about law, it would be an impertinence which I cannot afford and which you cannot tolerate. I am not going to talk about law because I am a layman, but at times it is very necessary for dignitaries of the legal profession to know how and what a layman feels about law. We know that there are three stages in law. My friend Mr. Seshadri was explaining the first stage, law making. There is the other stage of maintenance of law, a sort of hastiness, a sort of hectic activity which does not speak well either of the intelligence of this country or of the dignity of law. Taking the first, making of law, he has stated that I am a parliamentarian. Fortunately or unfortunately, I am so. But I may just tell you how we make law. Because remember, whatever may be the defect in our law making, the society is expected to maintain that law. And you, sir, are expected to help us in the maintenance of law, however defective it might be. When I say defective law, I do not mean defects that can be cut down by law courts, but defects in thinking, defects in analysis, defects in perception, and defects even in one's sentiments and prejudices. How do we make law? We are 500 strong in the Lok Sabha, 300 in the upper house. Whenever a proposal is brought forward, if it is a government proposal, even before the proposal is introduced before the house, the party in power and the parliamentarians connected with that party meet together. They discuss it amongst themselves. There are dissenting voices. There may be protests, weak or loud, as the season may be. And after what is called a consensus or adjustment, then the entire team enters the house determined to carry out that proposal into law. And whatever may be the opposition presented in the parliament, and you know the structure, the stature, and the sentiment of the opposition today in the parliament, we are at least half a dozen parties there, not only divided amongst ourselves, but determined to annihilate each other. And therefore, when such a weak and varied opposition, even if it were to present a stout opposition to the proposals before the house, number carries the day, and the proposal becomes a law. And then once it is made law, intellectuals, professorial intellectuals, and scholarly people come forward to ask society to maintain law. But I think that the maintenance of law, being the second stage in law, unless the first stage is perfect, unless the first stage is perfect to this extent that the people will have a sort of reciprocal interest in it, you cannot carry out the second stage. Maintenance of life going to become more and more difficult and more and more dangerous as the first stage in lawmaking becomes more and more defective. Now I would ask you to come along with me to the parliament. A proposal is mooted, the mover brings forward a new measure, and he expatiates and says that nobody else except himself has thought about it, and everybody should feel thankful to him for bringing forward that measure. And then the opposition stands up to say that this is a measure worthy of Draken and other tyrants and not in this democratic house. And the speaker is very watchful. Wherever he finds members of the government side being embarrassed, up comes his authoritative voice, he says, 2 more minutes only. And then the opposite member, when that voice, centurion voice of the speaker announces that there are only 2 more minutes, he forgets the proposal and he is reminded of his constituency, and therefore whether there is relevancy or not, he talks for the other 2 minutes about his constituency, and then he sits down, comfortable in the thought that the next time he meets members of his constituency, he may point out those 2 sentences which he has made to the constituency and say, well, re-elect me because I have spoken about you. This is how laws are being proposed and carried out there. I was reminded when my friend Narayana Swami was talking about fundamental rights. I may tell you, I have had the occasion to hear the then Law Minister, Mr. A.K. Sen, defending emergencies and defending also ordinances and defending the Defense of India rules as eloquently as he is today defending fundamental rights last week, which shows that there are lawyers and lawyers, that even lawyers, eminent lawyer as he is, even when such a lawyer is called upon to occupy an office, when he is asked to occupy a place in the cabinet, he forgets that it is his duty to give an exposition of law and not merely to maintain authority. But I was present in the house when the former Law Minister A.K. Sen was defending the DAR. He was telling that the interest of the country is foremost. And the interest of country is foremost, nobody should question about individual rights and fundamental rights and human rights. Human beings are individual stuff only, next to the interest of the country, and therefore it has become necessary for the introduction of the Defense of India rules. I read a couple of days back a fairly large report in a Calcutta daily about a speech delivered by the ex-law minister, Mr. A.K. Sen, and he has stated very clearly, very cogently, and even very warmly, that unless fundamental rights are maintained, there is no meaning in talking about emergency. Emergency or no emergency, the one emergent factor today is restore fundamental rights, which may perhaps mean restore my former position, unless you can afford to have my opposition to this DAR. That is the second stage which I have mentioned, maintenance of law. If law is being maintained unmindful of individual rights or fundamental rights by people who occupy seats of the cabinet, well, the stage has now come when you should come forward to give you a studied opinion about law as it should be, and not merely confine yourself to law as it is. I know that members of the bar and the bench in this state of ours have got such a legal acumen that they can give a faithful interpretation of law, in which I don't think that many from this country or outside can compete. We have got some of the best jurists in this country. We have got some of the best interpreters of law in this country. But they are concerned not with law as it should be, but with law as it is. I know many a presiding officer in a court, after pronouncing judgment, when he enters his house, he may think that he has done something wrong. Wrong, not according to law, but according to his own conscience. Therefore, it is that we should equate law with justice, law with political consciousness, law with ethics, and law with our own conscience. How to achieve that is a very difficult problem, but however difficult the problem might be, unless we solve that problem, we are not going to succeed in maintaining law. Why do you think that hundreds and thousands of people on a particular day come forward to defy law? Don't they know that we have got a powerful police force? They do know. Don't they know that there are penal courts? They are aware of them. Are they not aware that there are presiding officers who will look to the paper and not even to the person when they pronounce judgments? They are perfectly aware of that. And yet, as the old adage says, necessity knows no law. Necessity, whether artificial or created, necessity, whether spontaneous or inculcated by political party, whatever may be the adjective or that you might qualify it with, necessity knows no law. Therefore, our purpose ought to be to make the people have a spontaneous dignity towards law. They should know that law is being enacted by people who know what they are doing. They should realize, they should be made to realize that no law has been hastily passed. All the pros and cons have been discussed, that the law has been passed for the common good, as my friend Seshadri was kind enough to point out. And when one people realize that law has been created for their benefit, for the common benefit, please believe in me when I say that our people are the most law-abiding in the whole world. But today we find laws being brought forward and passed in legislatures and in parliament in the wink of a time. How many times have we amended our constitution? Constitution is the most sacred legal document that we have produced. It is the bedrock on which our entire political system and our political future is expected to depend. And yet, whenever there is a new session of parliament, you will find a short note in the dailies that there may be an amendment to the constitution. Simply that. For what? Only the next note will explain. Why? The third note will explain. And before you finish the third note, the amendment will be brought forward and carried, because today we have got not lawmakers as they ought to be, but lawmakers as they are today. My friends were telling that the level of lawmaking should rise. No level could rise unless society's level itself is risen. Because even a parliament, though it may be the supreme political body, the supreme legal body, and sometimes the supreme judicial body too, even that body cannot attain perfection, cannot attain a high level unless it reflects the high level of society. And when my friend Seshadri and Narayana Swami were telling me that members of the bar are not represented there, members of the bar have not taken active or enough interest in the politics of the day, how do you expect the level of the supreme political body or the supreme legal body to be very high? You expect too much, or you expect the impossible. Therefore, if we want that democratic legislation should attain at least a level of dignity which an imperialist government was able to maintain, we should see to it that we do not rush through legislation. We should not brush aside opinions coming from the opposition, even if they are weak and vacillating. I will give you one instance to prove this, to illustrate this, not to take you into the realm of party politics. Now, the present Madras government have announced through the Chief Minister that they are going to do away with land revenue as a whole. A very welcome measure. I personally feel the party to which I belong feels like that, and most of the people in this country also are thankful to that measure. But I am not concerned with the politics behind that measure. I am not concerned even with the political ethics of that measure, whether it is political ethics to announce such a measure on the eve of an election. We shall reserve that for other platforms. But I would ask you to remember that the Madras government through its chief minister has announced not remission or reduction, but doing away of the land revenue as a whole. If that is the studied opinion or the decided view of the Madras government, we should be in a position to find out that the present government is thinking along this line 6 months before, 1 year before, 2 months before. No, the contrary is not true. Some 4 months back, members of the opposition, when they brought forward a motion, not for the abolition of land revenue, but for the reduction of land revenue, the Chief Minister of Madras, who has now given this princely award of taking away land revenue, he stood up to say that anybody proposing either reduction or abolition of land revenue does not know what he talks. Now, on that day, when we read it in the papers, we applauded the Chief Minister. We said, here is a strong man, strong enough to get up and say that those who want reduction of land revenue talk some things which they do not know. And he went on the argument. And Faraday points out, if that were to be a case before your court, you would pronounce judgment in the Chief Minister's favor, because it is very logical. He has stated, we tax people who have got land. Whom else can we tax? If you want us not to tax people with land, whom do you want me to tax? And members of his party stood up in amazement of God and say, what a fine logic our Chief Minister has got. And members of the opposition are cowed down because they thought, well, after all the Chief Minister is saying that he is taxing people with land, who are we to question his wisdom? Now I am leaving the political side of that at that stage. Now I am taking you into the legal aspect of that problem. Law should be continuous. Law should not be haphazard. Law making should not be hectic. It should not be what has been termed by Professor Lofty as apoplexy at the center and anemia at the extremes. People not thinking at all about law, and lawmakers having fits of law, making new laws as they think that they should have. Unless there is less of apoplexy at the top and more blood in anemic body politics, you are not going to have law. And what laws are presented to the members of the bar and to the bench, I know gives them such an amount of headache that they think that it would have been better if they had been consulted before these laws were being framed. That is why in the High Court of Madras, some of the clauses and sections of law talk have been struck down. And what is the people thinking when a particular clause or a particular section in a law enacted by the Madras legislature is being struck down? People, because they are not well-versed in law-making, and in the democratic process through which law is being made, they take up the paper and say, oh, this is the judgment from that particular judge. He is not such a good friend of so-and-so. Therefore, he has struck it down. And if another gives another judgment, people untutored, ignorant, I admit, but they say, this judgment is because so-and-so is related to or attached to us, so-and-so because of this and that. I don't want you even to fill up the blanks because it will lead you to ugly conclusions. But people today do see that the court should be the custodian of not merely interpreting law, but even rectifying law, because they know our lawmakers, they know the equipment that our lawmakers have got. As my friends have stated, the political profession is the one profession wherein no certificate is required, no credential is offered, no equipment is required. The lesser of this, the greater the position you are taking. To become a lawyer, you have to pass through the law college. Sometimes, nowadays, people do really sit in the law colleges. In our days, they merely pass through the law colleges. Therefore, I say passing through the law colleges. Nowadays, they are expected to sit through, and after getting their law degree, they have to sit at their feet in the old traditional way with a senior lawyer, pick up his legal acumen, not his gesticulations alone, and equip themselves with all the legal niceties, build up a practice, and before he is known as a reliable lawyer, he gets gray hair. That is the legal profession if it is attained success. So to other professions, take the teaching profession, take the officers in the police department, take any other profession, they have to pass through a valley of sacrifice, a valley as it were of fire and brimstone. But the one valley firing, the political profession firing, nothing is demanded of you except the art of meeting people and smiling at them, whether you are happy or not. You should know the art of smiling, whether you feel happy or not, and if you succeed in that, you get yourself a place in the politics of the day. Now, that is not how the political profession should get a nobility of its own, because democracy is such a delicate machinery. Democracy is such a machinery which is beset with various dangers, that unless, as my friend very correctly pointed out, democracy, unless it is equated with meritocracy, not equated with caste or creed, religion or money, but meritocracy equated with equipment and service. Unless democracy is not equated with mediocrity, we are not going to have laws which can be spontaneously obeyed by the people. Nowadays, wherever a law is being passed, people who may be generally termed as people who are enemies of social cohesion, they are able to find out loopholes in law. Loopholes in law, a paradox in terms. Because law means that it creates such an amount of climate that everybody will think that justice is better out to him. But if we talk about loopholes and vagaries of social enemies, how it will withstand time and factors connected with time. Therefore, it is that lawmakers should be equipped with a sort of legal acumen, at any rate, elementary legal acumen. For that, I would say that all the political parties, or leaving aside political parties, the government of the day itself should constitute an institute of public life. Wherein, whoever wants to enter politics, of this party or that party, he should undergo a training. At any rate, he should be conversant with an elementary knowledge of law, an elementary knowledge of ethics and morality, something about world history, something about current politics, something about our country, ancient and present, and unless he passes out of that institute, no political party should put him on the political platform. If either the government or political parties amongst themselves create such a convention, they cannot make politics become a noble profession as it is expected it to be. At any rate, I was a bit stunned when my friend Narayana Swami called politics a profession. It is not even a profession. That is the most pathetic part of it. It is a hobby for some, it is the accident of others, and it is fortune hunting for a good man. If at any rate politics has become a profession, one would have equipped himself for that profession. Therefore, my plea before this august house would be that you should persuade the government of the day and the government of tomorrow to constitute an institute of public affairs or public people who want to enter the political arena of this party or that party. After entering political parties, then what I have previously stated, smiling without happiness, meeting friends, and making no enemies, all these things can be considered, but the basic equipment ought to be that he should equip himself with at least the rudiments of all these things. Now, the lack of such a rudimentary knowledge is the bane of not merely politics, but even of democracy itself. Because believe me when I say that our country is not safe today for democracy. It was a former president of the United States of America, Woodrow Wilson. He said that we should make the world safe for democracy. Taking that from him, we may conveniently say that our country today is not safe for democracy. Unless we make this country safe for democracy, we are making ourselves to be left to a disaster in politics. And when once that disaster takes place, there cannot be resurrection in politics very easily. For what do we find today in Indonesia? What do we find in our neighboring country, Pakistan? What do we find in some of the newly created independent African countries? We find they do have the democratic machinery since the 5 years. They do print, construct polling booths, that spirit. Because of the lack of that, the now unseated Republican President of Ghana, Dr. Nkrumah, when he wanted some of his political opponents to be prosecuted, and when the Supreme Court judge of Ghana, when the case before him, he studied the case as a judge ought to study, and he said, such and such people should be sentenced, and these people are acquitted. The moment the Supreme Court judge delivered the judgment, up rose Dr. Nkrumah from his presidential palace and said, who is that judge? And members of his political party said, we were all along warning you, you ought not to have made him as a Supreme Court judge, this is what you get from him. And Dr. Nkrumah said, what I can make, I can unmake. Therefore, the next day, he asked his parliament to meet. And in the parliament, he rushes the legislature which says that the president of Ghana is empowered to give, to annihilate judgments offered by even the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can give a judgment, but to nullify the Supreme Court judgment and acquit or convict as the case may be. And that Supreme Court judge would have laughed within his sleep because he ought to have been conversant with such autocracy perpetrated in a comparatively calm country like England. And yet, when members of the bar and the bench stood together as against the autocracy of Charles I and Charles II, it was a monarch who had to go and not members of the bar and the bench. And today we find in Ghana, the repeat police depart this country throughout the world. And the Supreme Court judge who was dismissed by the Republican President of Ghana being taken as an honored member of the cabinet of that country. Now that is one instance of the danger of being independent and also of the loyalty shown by the people for people who maintain independence of judgment. Therefore it is that I say that the time has come for members of the bar to interpret law according to their conscience and not only that, meet in their associations, if not in their courts, to meet in their associations and give the studied opinion about this or that law, about this proposal or that matter, so that they can be supplementing the ill-equipped politician of today. If somebody wants to talk that, politicians may find fault with him. It is myself I am talking, therefore no politician can find fault. We are give that. Make bold to say that such and such rules and regulations ought to be altered. Process at least after the case is over. If not in the court, at least outside the court. defraud yourself at least through men like me. Study the legal system, the legal chief justice of Madras, having some nice and kind words about the legacy of the British people as far as the legal system and the system of jurisprudence is concerned. Nobody doubts about that. But a time has come when we should process of law, as it were, whether the old process of law is enough or whether it suits the present-day moods and present-day deeds. And we should so recreate the entire spirit behind law that people will readily and spontaneously obey law. We should never forget this fact, my friends, that the dissenters of today are the lawmakers of tomorrow. One should never forget that. And if anybody is apt to forget it, I may only remind them that the lawbreakers of yesterday are the lawmakers of today. Therefore, we should not shun at the mere expression of dissent or even protest. Because dissent is, after all, looking at a problem from an entirely different angle. They are not outside the problem. They are not antagonistic to the problem. But when one's eye and mind are riveted in one particular angle, some bolder spirits, like the astronauts of Soviet Russia and America, they want to see the other side of the moon, not this side. Some bolder spirits in public life, they want to find out the other point of view, the other angle. A very hazardous affair, a very risky process, a very dangerous luxury. And yet, there are some bolder spirits who want to know what consists in the other angle. And when people who look towards the other angle are considered to protest against authority, or protest even against certain legal tenets, we should not rush to the conclusion and say that these people do not respect law. They respect more the spirit behind law, perhaps they do not respect the letter in law, because the letter has been inserted there, sometimes by unlettered people, at other times by illettered people, and most of the times by hastily learned people. And therefore they do not obey the entire letter of the law. But they have got perfect dignity and perfect respect for the spirit behind law. For after all, what is the purpose of law? The purpose of law is the maintenance of justice. And justice is not going to endanger me. It is not going to endanger another individual. Because justice means social cohesion, giving for each his worth, his might, and what he demands, what he needs, what is his. Therefore, maintenance of justice ought to be the spirit towards which law making itself should migrate or be or taken towards. And for that purpose, if you rely merely on politicians, we cannot arrive at that stage in this decade or in the next decade. Therefore, even as my friend Varayana Sarvi has stated, even if political parties are not very responsive in giving due place to educated people, I would request members of the educated section to bear this in mind, that people in the enjoyment of anything do not easily give up. Even a first class passenger does not easily give up his seat, even when the third whistle is blown. Therefore, I would request members of the educated public to supplement what the politicians of today are able to contribute. That ought to be the first stage in which educated sections should get itself interested, and when what they give is being valued, and when the politicians find that they get from the educated section something which they are all along lacking, then they will come forward to the educated section and say, come along and take responsibility. And to that end, the educated section should get itself interested, because at least in the future parliament and in the future legislature, we should have men making laws who know what they are making. As Professor Gimman has very pertinently pointed out, members of the parliament should be so equipped that they should know something about everything and everything about something. They should know everything about something. They should be experts in some particular branch of knowledge, and they should know something about everything. Because he's a dentist, he could, if a doctor has to say, oh, I am a mere dentist, I don't know whether it is malaria or influenza, go to some other doctor. If a politician were to say like that, then it would be very bad. Therefore, Professor Jimar has stated, a member of the parliament should know something about everything, and everything about something. He should be an expert in a particular branch of knowledge, and he should be conversant with all other avenues of knowledge to some extent at any rate. The present day, we don't have people who know something about everything, but everything about something. But we have got plenty of people who say, everything to me and nothing to nobody else. If that is to be the future parliament, then we may not be sure that the next decade we will be having democracy in its prescribed purity. Therefore, the lawyer's duty is to safeguard democracy. Because in an autocracy, the lawyer is put to this difficulty. At least in a democracy, he knows what law is till a new law is enacted. In an autocracy, the throne of the autocrat is the law of the day. And therefore, at that stage, lawyers or even members of the bench will find it very irksome and very dangerous either to argue or to pronounce judgment. Therefore, it is the interest of the members of the legal profession to see that democracy is perfected, and it can be perfected only by people who can contribute something to raise the level of politics, legislation, and the entire field of political ethics and morality. Thank you.